And welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast, a podcast committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet directly to your earbuds. And today, we're not only talking about someone who is interesting, informative, and inspirational, but someone who's brought a book to us that is the quintessence of those three parts of our mission statement. The book is interesting, it's informative, and it is inspirational. And it's a book that is directly needed for our epoch of time. Now, before I introduce Nancy formally, I want to read something that Jay Richards said about the book that is the topic for today's discussion. The title of the book, The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes. Jay Richards says this, and when Jay Richards speaks, I listen. I've had him on the podcast, on the broadcast. I've featured him in the Christian Research Journal. He is someone that I have such great respect for. And he says this about the book, The Toxic War on Masculinity. The first thing he says is, this is the very book we need right now. The world and far too much of the church are confused on the question of our sexual natures in general and manhood in particular. Nancy Piercy provides the decisive defense of masculinity, rightly understood, against distortions to the left and to the right. She shows why Christianity not only gives the best account of manhood, but also serves to form the sort of men the world and families need. And then he ends with this line, everyone should read, indeed, study this book. So at the very outset, before I've even introduced the guest and the author of this book, let me say that The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes, is must reading. It's written by Nancy Piercy. It's available for anyone who stands shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. You can get your copy on the web at equip.org. You can write me at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. But make sure you get this book and read this book. As is my habit, I go through the book one time in a cursory fashion, kind of speed read the book. Then I go through with a Pentel and later with a highlighter. And when you do this with a book like this, you will have so many aha moments. Not only ones that are fleeting, but stick in your mind and then equip you to make a difference while there is yet time. So I'm a big fan of the book that we're talking about today, The Toxic War on Masculinity. The author, Nancy Piercy. Nancy, I mean, she has so many credits to her name. She's a professor of apologetics, one of the great apologetics of our era. She's a scholar in residence at Houston Christian University. She's a best-selling author and speaker. Her books have been translated into myriad languages. Some of the books that we featured on the Bible Answer Man broadcast and on the Hank Unplugged podcast, Total Truth, Love Thy Body, and this book, of course, The Toxic War on Masculinity. We appreciate the work of Nancy Piercy. She's making a difference while there's yet time, and very, very pleased to have you on the Hank Unplugged podcast.
Thank you very much. It's good to see you again.
It is great to see you as well. I guess the first thing I want to say about this book is it's a very clever title. We hear the phrase toxic masculinity, but this book is The Toxic War on Masculinity. Whenever you come up with a title, there's always a story behind it. So I'm sure there's a story here as well.
Well, it's true. I wanted to get the words toxic and masculinity in there because, of course, that is the phrase of our day. But I didn't want to use the term toxic masculinity because I do not agree that there is toxic masculinity or that masculinity in itself is toxic. And so I did try to come up with some play on words. And I'm glad you liked it because not everyone quite gets it. Like, wait a minute, what are you saying? You know, that people always do sort of a double take. Though that's not bad either. So I did want to catch people's attention with the two words, toxic and masculinity. But to say that actually men are doing much worse today than they were in the past. And there is a problem now with the hostility that's being shown against men. I'll just give you two examples. When I told my class I was writing a book on masculinity, a male student shot back, "What masculinity? It's been beaten out of us."
Huh.
So even Christian people feel that masculinity is being demeaned and demoted today. And I also quote a psychotherapist who writes regularly for the Wall Street Journal. And I was really impressed with this statement. She said, "The young men coming into my practice today all feel demoralized and defeated because they feel like they're growing up in a culture that's hostile to masculinity." So that's what I wanted to capture in the title, is that we do have a problem with outright hostility against masculinity today.
Yeah, Nancy, before I actually get into the subject matter of the book, I want you to talk a little bit about your background, particularly the way you've been impacted by LaBrie and by Francis Schaeffer.
Oh, yes, very much so. It is why I'm a Christian today. So I grew up in a Lutheran home. I don't know if you know this, but all Scandinavians are Lutheran. My dad's Swedish, my mom's Norwegian, and it's a state church, or it was in the past, and it's like all Irish or Catholic. So as a result, the weakness of that is that often people rely on the ethnicity to hold you. And in my home, there was not a lot of really firm, authentic, personal conviction. And so when I was in high school, I started asking questions. Actually, just one question. I started asking, how do we know Christianity is true? I'm attending a public high school. All my textbooks are secular. All my teachers are secular. And I started simply asking, how do we know Christianity is true? And unfortunately, none of the adults in my life could answer that. I asked a Christian university professor, point blank. I just said, "Why are you a Christian?" He said, "Works for me." That's it. "You're a university professor." And I had a chance to talk to a seminary dean, and I thought I would get a more substantial answer from him. And all he said was, "Don't worry, we all have doubts sometimes," as if it were a psychological phase that I was going through. And so about halfway through high school, I very intentionally walked away from my Christian upbringing. I decided, I guess Christianity doesn't have any answers, and it's up to me to find out what is really true. And I literally started walking down the hallway at the public high school I attended and pulling books off the philosophy shelf, because I thought, if I can't get any people to talk to me about this, maybe these dead guys, right? These philosophers have some answers, because that's their job after all, right? A philosopher is supposed to answer questions like, what is truth and how do we know it? And is there a foundation for ethics? Or is it just true for me, true for you? Is there any meaning to life? And I quickly decided, if there is no God, the answer to all those questions is no. There is no meaning to life. We're a chemical accident on a rock flying through space. There's no foundation for morality if there's no transcendent standard. You know, I even realized there's no foundation for knowledge itself, because the way I thought of it was, if all I have is my puny brain and the vast scope of time and space, what makes me think I could attain some kind of universal, objective, absolute truth? Ridiculous. That's how I thought of it as a 16-year-old. Ridiculous. And so in my science classes, I also picked up determinism. In other words, I was taught that we're just complex biochemical machines. So there's no free will anyway. So by the time I graduated from high school, I had absorbed all of these secular isms. And it was a few years later, I was in Europe. We had lived in Europe when I was a child. And so all through high school, I saved up my money so I could go back. And in Europe, I stumbled across LaBrie, the ministry of Francis Schaeffer, which is known as an apologetics ministry. And I had never heard any apologetics before. I was blown away. I was so impressed. I had never encountered Christians who could engage with the secular isms that I had absorbed by that time, and who could show that Christianity had solid, good answers, that Christianity could be defended by good reasons and arguments and evidence and logic. So I was amazed. And it took a year and a half. I didn't want to give up the fight immediately, but I did eventually become convinced that Christianity was true. Because Christianity had let me down already once before as a child, I didn't want to rush into it quickly. I wanted to be absolutely intellectually convinced that it was true. And it took a year and a half, but I did finally come to that position. And that's why I teach apologetics now, right? I teach it, I write it. I really have a heart to reach out to young people who have the kind of questions that I had when I was young.
And that is universal around the world. I mean, I have found as I travel the world that people desperately want answers. And that's why I'm so excited to have you on the podcast, because, I mean, you've given your life to giving answers and equipping people to always be ready to give a reason for the hope that lies within them with gentleness and with respect, which is part of the mission statement of the Christian Research Institute. I want to get back to the subject matter of your book and something that you said at the very beginning of the podcast, where if you think masculinity is the problem, then emasculation becomes the solution. You alluded to that, but I want you to expand on that a little bit, because I think that's the heart of the book, in essence.
Yes, well, my eye was caught. One reason I wrote the book is because I was noticing how it has become socially acceptable to express extreme hostility against men. The Washington Post had an article titled, "Why Can't We Hate Men?" I thought, really? In a respected mainstream publication? A Huffington Post editor tweeted, hashtag, kill all men. You can buy t-shirts that say, so many men, so little ammunition. There are actually books with titles like, I Hate Men, No Good Men, and Are Men Necessary? And even some men are jumping on the bandwagon. There's a male author whose book is quoted sometimes who said, talking about healthy masculinity is like talking about healthy cancer. And you may have seen this one. It's not in my book because it came out more recently. It was just in the news a couple of weeks ago. The director of the movie Avatar, James Cameron, was quoted in the news because he said, testosterone is a toxin that you have to work out of your system. So no wonder a recent survey found that 46% of American men agree with the statement, these days, society seems to punish men just for acting like men. And there was an even more recent one. Again, the more recent one's not in the book. It was done in Britain. 55% of men agreed with that statement. So it's going up. And so it's clear that even if you don't agree with that, that is a large percentage of the population who now think men are getting a bad deal. And so it is something that we need to pay attention to and find solutions to. And you're right, it's not emasculation. We have to find ways to affirm masculinity as a good thing. Obviously, God created men to be masculine as he created women to be feminine. And so we need to find ways to affirm that even in our modern culture.
Yeah, well said. Talk about the problem of stereotypes, the real man versus the good man. That would be a stereotypical statement that you would hear. It's a narrative, but there's a problem with that stereotype.
Yes, I put this right at the front of the book, and I'll give you some of the background to this. This has turned out to be the most controversial book I've written, which surprised me. I really thought my earlier book, Love Thy Body, would be the most controversial book because it deals with abortion, homosexuality, transgenderism, which is such a cutting-edge issue today. But this one actually was more controversial. And I led classes on it. I led reading groups on it to catch all the rough edges, right? And when they would tell their friends and family about this manuscript we were going through, invariably the first question was, whose side is she on? Just with that tone, whose side is she on? Men tended to think she's probably some male-bashing feminist. And progressives thought, well, she's probably some defensive, angry reactionary. And so I put that study, the study of the good man versus the real man, I put that right at the beginning because it kind of diffuses that hostility, that opposition. This was a study done by a sociologist. He's not a Christian, but he's well known. And so he gets invited to speak all around the world. And so he came up with this clever experiment. He asked young men two questions. First, he asked them, what does it mean to be a good man? And he said, all around the world, young men had no problem answering that. They answered things like honor, duty, sacrifice, integrity, do the right thing, be a provider, be a protector, be responsible, be generous. And he would ask them, well, where'd you learn that? This is, well, it's just in the air we breathe. Or if it was in a Western country, they would say it's part of our Judeo-Christian heritage. Mm. And then he would follow up with a second question. He'd say, what does it mean if I say to you, man up, be a real man? And the young man would say, no, 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 that's completely different. That means be strong, be tough, never give up, win at all costs, suck it up, be competitive, get rich, get laid. I'm using their language. And what it means is that men are actually caught between these two opposing scripts. We would say because men are made in God's image, they do know what it means to be a good man. This sociologist said he was finding the same thing with Brazil, Sweden, Australia. Young men have an innate, inherent knowledge of what it means to be a good man. Or we would say Romans 2, right? We all have a conscience. But they do feel social pressure to live up to the script of the real man, which does include traits that we might consider more toxic, at least if it's decoupled from the moral ideal of the good man. It can easily slide into traits like entitlement and dominance and power and control. And so it gives us, I would suggest, a fresh way of dealing with these issues. Instead of calling men toxic, you know, not too many men respond well to being called toxic. Nobody would. So instead, what we should do is try to tap into their innate knowledge of what it means to be a good man, support and affirm and encourage that inherent knowledge of the good man. And that gives us a much more positive way to approach these issues.
Yeah, wow. You know, when you talk about this stereotypical idea of men today and the culture, the bashing of maleness and so forth, you get anti-male sentiment in the institutions that control our culture today. Educational, you're in the educational field. That's a hotbed for anti-male sentiment.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And, you know, I found that this is something I also had to put in the first chapter of the book. Because people were often challenged me by, well, what do you think the differences between men and women are then? Because that becomes a hot point, right? As soon as you say there's differences, people will challenge you. Because, well, it is true that once you acknowledge a difference, it is typical for people to say, well, these traits are less than, you know, these traits are inferior. And so I start with just biology. Biology gives us the bare basics, right? Men are bigger, stronger, faster. Because of testosterone, they do tend to be more aggressive, more risk-taking. They even have more fast twitch muscles. That's a term I had to learn. It means they can react more quickly. And so these are good gifts from God. This is how men are made. And we need to affirm that God made men with these qualities, with these characteristics. And the reason, like I say, that many people don't want to acknowledge differences is because they're afraid that if we say these are good strengths of men, you talk about education. Even in a Christian university, most of my female students identify as feminist. And the minute I said anything positive about men, even men are strong, they would say, well, women are strong too. And so you'd have to immediately say, yes, yes, yes. But women, to some degree, have different strengths. And it's important, though, that we describe them as strengths.
Yes.
In other words, take, for example, our superpower, of course, is that we can have children. And having children also leads to certain character traits. We have more oxytocin, which is the bonding hormone, which makes women, on the whole, more nurturing. And taking care of an infant is incredibly demanding. You have to be willing to be interrupted any time of the day, even 3 o'clock in the morning. No matter what you're doing, you have to be willing to put it aside and meet the infant's distress. When an infant's distressed, you don't reason with them, you don't scold them, you meet their distress, no matter what you wanted to be doing at that time. And women become incredibly patient. They have to be incredibly sensitive to nonverbal cues because the babies aren't talking yet. And of course, they become very sensitive to threats in the environment. So they become mama bears. So it is important that when we talk about the differences, we talk about them both in terms of strengths, you know, the male strengths and the female strengths. So that kind of reduces some of the hostility that, you know, like I say, I get it even in a Christian school. You have to make sure that you are presenting both sides as strengths, as God-given gifts, that we should be thankful for these differences because they're from God and that we serve one another through these differences.
Nancy, you mentioned oxytocin. I found a fascinating part of your book where you mention that the level of oxytocin rises in men when they're bonding with their children. The biological change that takes place obviously is evident in a woman, but I was absolutely fascinated. I'm the father of 12 children. I did not know that that was a biological reality.
Yes, I'm not averse to appealing to self-interest in asking men to be more involved fathers. You know, often that message comes across in sort of a scolding tone, right? I have a graduate student who's the leader of the women's ministry at a large Baptist church. And she said, when on Mother's Day, we hand out roses and tell the women how wonderful they are. On Father's Day, we scold the men and tell them to do better. So that's why I said I have a section in there on how men benefit from becoming fathers. I have quotes from many men saying, I never knew fatherhood would be so fulfilling, because we don't hear that today anymore. There's literally neurons in the brain that get activated when a man becomes a father. One psychologist calls it the dad brain. The dad brain is a nest of neurons that don't wake up unless you actually become a father. And so oxytocin is part of that. Yes, we've always been told that women's oxytocin rises during pregnancy. It turns out that a man's oxytocin also rises when he becomes a father, but he has to be actively holding and touching his child. It's stimulated by tactile sense. So if a father is actively holding his child, his oxytocin goes up as well. And which, you know, I know when I became a mother, I wanted all the help I could get. I was very thankful for this biochemical boost to help me become a better parent. And here's the really surprising thing. This is the most recent finding. It's by an anthropologist. And she found that the oxytocin in men goes up even during the wife's pregnancy. In other words, it doesn't wait until the baby's born. If the husband and wife are living together, his oxytocin goes up as well. I guess nobody ever thought to test a man's blood while his wife was pregnant. But when they did, they found out that men are being primed. God has equipped men to be primed to be a full member of the parenting team, biochemically primed all the way through his wife's pregnancy, as well as at the time of birth. So this was fascinating, because that's why so many men, do bond so closely with their children and do feel as if that's an important part of their manhood. Since the Industrial Revolution, we have pretty much taught men that they get their main identity from their work, from their career. And we have overlooked how much they do get a sense of a validation of their masculinity by becoming involved fathers as well.
Yeah, and that was just one of the 100, 200, 300, I don't know. I had so many aha moments reading through your book, and that certainly is at the top of the list. I got sort of a poignant question here, and that is, how has pornography impacted the idea of what it is to be a man?
Oh, it's had a tremendous influence. Unfortunately, boys are now exposed to pornography from about age 9. It's on their phone, it's in their music videos, it's everywhere. And some people put it this way, boys are getting their sex education from porn more than they are from school. And it's a very bad education. It is training them, of course, to see women as primarily objects of their sexual lust. It is training them to think that women like certain kinds of activities that most women don't like, that women find painful or demeaning. And I talk about it some in chapter 1. I deal with it more in my book, Love Thy Body. So I only touch on it in this book. But it is part of the way that boys are being brought up by our culture to be more toxic. We don't educate them in school, right? They're falling behind in education from kindergarten all the way through college and graduate school. By the way, I just saw a graph today. Colleges are about 60% female, 40% male now. When I started at Houston Christian University, by the way, it was 70-30. A lot of the smaller Christian colleges, right? 70-30. So we're working hard to change that. We brought in football and we brought in engineering to attract more male students. But more women than men are graduating from college. More women are graduating from graduate school and even professional schools like law and medicine. And so we're failing to educate boys. There are books out with titles like The War Against Boys, The Boy Crisis, Why Boys Fail. People are acknowledging that our society is failing boys. And I think the pornography fits into that. We're failing to train boys to be responsible, mature men who care about women and children, who are protective of women and children. And then we wonder why they turn out to have toxic behavior. It's because our culture is not training them up to be honorable, productive men.
If a man gets involved in pornography, gets addicted to pornography, can he have a proper or a successful relationship with a woman?
I don't think so. No, there's been so many studies on this. There was a Washington Post article that said, I don't care if pornography is moral or not. You know, it's a secular writer. Whether it's moral or not, it's a public health crisis. And the reason that the article called it a public health crisis is because pornography is training so many men in being abusive, in being violent. Something like 80% of the most watched porn involves violence. And so it is literally training men to associate sexual feelings with violence. And that's why this article called it a public health crisis, because it is training men to be violent and to be like Andrew Tate, if we want to bring in his, you know, so many young men are looking up to Andrew Tate, and it's turning out, of course, that he himself calls himself a pimp. That's his own word. And he himself says, I don't care about these women. I'm just using them as a means to make money. Well, I think that's a pretty good example of where porn is leading young men today, is they look up to men like Andrew Tate. So I think that pornography trains men so much, not only, well, violence is the worst, but even if it's not violent, it's seeing women primarily as receptacles for their lust. Let's face it, to be blunt. So no, I don't think that a man who's addicted to porn can have a good, healthy, biblical relationship with his wife.
Yeah, so many destructive sociological aspects that we could talk about in that regard. Thinking about aha moments, here's another stunner for me, also a stunner for researchers, that if you are a committed church-going man, the statistics for being anything but toxic are humongous. But if you're just a nominal Christian man, wow, you actually fit the stereotype of toxic masculinity.
Yes, this was amazing. And it really is the final reason I decided to write the book, when I saw the positive outcomes of committed Christian men. So this is material that's not really out in the public. I had to go digging into these academic literature to find these studies. So I cite about a dozen studies showing that committed Christian men actually test out as the most loving and engaged husbands and fathers. Let me preface that by saying this is very much counter to the cultural narrative. In writing the book, a quick Google search found lots and lots of quotes saying that evangelical men who believe in any form of male headship are, of course, going to turn out to be oppressive, domineering, tyrannical patriarchs. I'll give you just one quote. So this was the co-founder of the Church Too movement, which followed the Me Too movement. She said, the theology of male headship feeds the rape culture that we see permeating American Christianity today. So what happened is the psychologists, sociologists were reading these accusations and saying, well, where's your evidence? You know, you're making these charges, where's your data? And so they went and did the studies. And they found that, as you said, committed, you know, authentic Christian men who attend church regularly test out as the most loving husbands and fathers. And by the way, the first pushback I always get is, well, of course, their wives said they were happy. Their husbands are sitting right next to them. So you have to clarify, no, these are very large population-wide studies, not done by Christian organizations. You know, there's secular people and Islamic and Jewish, you know, these are very large thousands of people done by secular organizations, like the General Social Survey, for example. And then people, various researchers will come and take what they are interested out of that data. And so these weren't, most of the studies were not Christians running them. and the wives were interviewed separately. At any rate, so what they're reporting is that the wives say that they are the happiest with their husband's expression of love and affection. Evangelical fathers are the most engaged with their children, both in terms of shared activities like sports and church youth group, and in terms of discipline, like setting limits on screen time and enforcing bedtime, 3.5 hours per week more than the average American father. Evangelical couples are the least likely to divorce, and they have the lowest rate of domestic abuse and violence of any major group in America. And when I read this, I was blown away. I had no idea. I was reading the critics like all of us were. And I said, I've got to get this out. I have to get this out into the public. The church needs to know this, because the church needs to understand that men who are committed Christians are doing a good job. They need to stop having that scolding tone that I talked about earlier and start affirming and supporting men and letting them know that they're doing a good job. But the other side of the coin, as you mentioned, is nominal Christians. So nominal means in name only. My students don't even know what the term means, so I have to explain to them. Nominal Christians, one of the most widely quoted statistics among Christian leaders, as you no doubt know, is that Christians divorce at the same rate as the rest of the culture. So the researchers went back to the data, and they did make that crucial distinction between committed Christians and nominal Christians. And as you said, the nominal Christians are shockingly different. They do fit all the toxic stereotypes. Their wives report the lowest level of happiness. They report the lowest level of engagement with their children. They have the highest rate of divorce, higher than secular men. And they have the highest rate of domestic abuse and violence, even higher than secular men. So this is why the statistics get so skewed, you know, because you have men who are better than secular men and men who are worse than secular men. So if you just do a broad-based discussion of evangelicals, of course, the numbers are going to be misleading. And it does suggest, again, what the church needs to do. Support the men who are doing a good job. Be aware that they are. You know, encourage them. They feel as beaten down as any other men do. But also, I think we need better programs to reach out to these men who are kind of at the fringes of the Christian world, who are claiming the identity of evangelical, and who we might say are ruining the reputation of evangelicals, because they're taking biblical language like headship and submission, but infusing it with meaning from the secular script for masculinity, infusing it with definitions like dominance, entitlement, control, and so on. And I sometimes have people ask me, well, but why are they worse than secular men if they're taking their definitions from the secular world? Well, it's because they're feeling like they have religious permission to act that way, right? So the secular person can be an abusive husband, say, but he doesn't have religious justification. The nominal Christian feels he has religious permission to act that way. And so he ends up actually having the worst of both worlds and being worse than secular men. So that's what we're up against in the church. We have the best and the worst, and we have to figure out a good strategy for dealing with men within the church.
Yeah, which you do in the book. And in chapter 3, titled The Paradox of Christian Marriage, What Christians Really Think About Headship, you just alluded to this. But elaborate on that, because there's such a stereotypical narrative about what headship actually entails. It's completely divorced from the real biblical understanding or the Christian understanding of headship.
Yes, I was surprised again, because this is all coming out of, you know, hard data, you know, empirical research, rigorous testing. I don't know if you know this, but when my book first appeared, like the day after the book appeared, it was viciously attacked by Christian egalitarians. I don't know if you're not on Twitter, you may not have noticed this. They took over my whole Twitter page for days, for weeks. And this was interesting, because I don't even debate the egalitarian complementarian issue in my book. I don't, because I'm not interested in these in-house debates. Well, there's two reasons. One is, two of my top researchers say that in practice, it doesn't seem to make much difference. This was fascinating. So Brad Wilcox is considered, he's at the University of Virginia. He's considered like the top marriage sociologist in the country. And his conclusion from his research was, I've tested men who are egalitarian and I've tested men who are complementarian. And he said, Complementarian men are not abusive. They do test out as the happiest, their most engaged, loving husbands and fathers. By the way, he's Catholic. So in a sense, he didn't have a dog in this fight because he, you know, I don't know that he was happy to find out that evangelical Protestant men test out on top at the highest level. And he tested egalitarian marriages and he said, they're not any happier. They don't test out as happier. And then there's a top marriage psychologist in the country, John Gottman. And he said the same thing. He said, I have people coming into my practice. Some of them believe the man should be in charge of his marriage. And I have people come in who are very egalitarian. And he said, you know, here's how he put it. Emotionally intelligent husbands have figured out the most important thing, which is how to convey honor and respect to your wife. Their gender theory does not seem to make a difference. So I just quoted that and said, okay, this is why I'm not going to deal with this question in my book. And then the first several weeks of the book was out, I got, you know, the book got dragged into that debate by Christian egalitarians. The second reason that I don't do it is because I'm an apologist, right? So I want to counter the secular charges. The secular world says, if you are an evangelical conservative Christian, you will be a domineering, abusive patriarch. And so I thought, well, let's find out. Let's look at these studies that were done of evangelical men. What do they say? And so chapter three is all pretty much all just quotes from Christian men and women saying what they think headship means. And once again, I was blown away by how loving and respectful their understanding of headship was. They did not define it primarily in terms of breadwinner or final authority or tiebreaker, some of the things we normally hear. They defined the most common phrase was spiritual leadership, spiritual leader. And if you press them, well, what do you mean by that? They would start with the most obvious practical things. Get your family to church on Sunday, get your kids to youth group, have family devotions, have family prayers. But it also was the less tangible things like being responsible for the spiritual life and welfare of your wife and children. And so I quoted a secular sociologist saying, wait a minute, how can you believe in headship and equal worth at the same time? Well, Christians have figured out how to do that. Yes, there's a headship in terms of a special kind of responsibility for the husband, but they don't think that that means that husband and wife have differing worth, that women are inferior or subordinate. They do believe that they're both made in God's image and clearly have the same spiritual status. So chapter three is just quoting Christian couples, showing what they think headship means. And I personally, I didn't expect it to be that positive. It was very, very positive.
Yeah, it's about responsibility, not privilege.
Yeah, that was a nice summary.
Yeah, so you say that Christian marriage was historically revolutionary, and then you expand on that in the book. And I think that is very eye-opening for our audience to hear. It's hard for people to go back, let's say, to first century Rome and see how women were treated within that context and how Christianity comes into that context and liberates women, exalts women. You know, obviously, Christ is the quintessential example of taking women and giving women significant roles. I mean, they're his entourage. They're part of his inner circle. Mary is the quintessence of theosis. I mean, she's everything that we hope to be. So marriage from a Christian standpoint was revolutionary to the culture. It was countercultural.
Yeah, it's difficult for us to make this point with our secular friends because Christianity has become the wallpaper, right? They don't realize how much our views of women and the value, dignity, significance of women has come from Christianity. So you get that perspective better if you go back to the first century. And what was the early church facing? Well, in Roman culture, women had very little status, very little value. Women were expected, well, marriage was to produce legal heirs, but there was not any expectation that there would be any real love and affection between husband and wife. Women were often married off as age 12 or 13. So they were much younger than their husbands. They had much less education. And it was almost more like marrying a child, right? As a result, husbands and wives had very little in common. And women were seen as inferior. Well, because they were so much younger. Men, it was totally socially acceptable for men to have sex with just about anybody, prostitutes, courtesans, mistresses, and most of all, their slaves. Slaves were the most common, both male and female, both adult and children. Pedophilia was a big part of it. And in fact, as you know, unwanted children were often put out. It was called exposed. They were exposed. They were put out to be, you know, killed by the wild beast or by the elements. Those children are sometimes rescued and raised in brothels to be sex slaves. So in this context, oh, and abortion, I should say, abortion and infanticide were committed primarily against baby girls. It was rare, historians tell us, it was rare for a Roman family to have more than one daughter. They would have a token girl, but that was it. Any more girls would be, again, killed or aborted. And abortion was a big killer of women too. If you insisted, there were some famous cases of people who insisted that, you know, they'd had sex outside of marriage, and so they insisted that the woman have an abortion. And abortion was a big killer of women at that time. So all that to say that when Christianity came on the scene and said, you need to be faithful in marriage, that was not a huge message for women, but it was revolutionary for men. Men were like shocked. What do you mean? We can't have sex outside of marriage. You find Augustine in the fourth century still admonishing Christian men that they should not have sex with their slaves. So we don't usually hear that. But even in the church, it was a difficult message for men to accept. It took several centuries. So sometimes that kind of historical perspective helps us to recognize Christianity applied the same moral standard to men as to a sexual standard of fidelity in marriage, chastity outside of marriage, to both men and women. And that was shocking at the time. In fact, I even quote a sermon from Augustine where he's addressing the man who's having sex with his slaves. And he's saying, you know, your wife is going to tell you that's wrong. You know, the wife is going to tell you, look, we heard at church that this was wrong and you need to stop. So yes, it was something that was even difficult for Christians to adopt. Now we take it for granted. We take so much of our Christianity for granted. It's become so endemic to our culture, but that's a big one. It was harder for men than for women. And I think that's what we need to understand. The Christian ethic demands a lot from men. It demands that they, like you said a moment ago, it's responsibility, a level of responsibility that they just don't face in the secular world.
So no small wonder that women were attracted to Christianity.
Good. Yes, that is the conclusion I draw. Exactly. Women were very much drawn to the early church. From the beginning, there were more women than men in the Christian church. One of the church fathers, I think it may have been Augustine, was saying, we have so many young women in the church, we don't have enough young men for them to marry. And even outsiders, outside critics commented on how, well, they would say it in a disparaging sense, right? Oh, Christianity, you know, this new cult here, it's primarily for women because there were so many women in the church. But today we think being against abortion, for example, is anti-women. At that time, they understood very well that being against abortion was pro-woman, that it showed respect for women in their reproductive capacities. And of course, as I said, many women were killed by abortion as well. The fact that the Christian church stood against adultery and fornication, women loved it because it was saying to them, your husband has to be focused on you. You don't have to share him with prostitutes and courtesans and mistresses and boys. By the way, I have a quote from a Roman poet who admonished Roman women that sex with boys was more pleasurable than sex with their wives. So stop complaining, is what he said, basically. There was even, you know, we have questions that are common in public discourse, like debates. We have debates over immigration, right? Or we have debates over COVID mandates or whatever. They had debates over, is sex with women better than sex with men? Which means a large number of people were debating that, no, sex with men is better, and especially sex with boys. So women, wives were sharing their husbands, not only with other women, but also with men and boys. When the gospel says to them, no, no men, you have to put all of your erotic energy, all your love and affection all your faithfulness on your wife. You have to invest your marriage with that kind of intensity. Had a huge impact on raising the status of women and of marriage.
We have just scratched the surface on aha moments, as I'd like to call them. But part two of the book, How the Secular Script Turned Toxic, I want to read two quotes from that section. It's actually in chapter four, titled Pioneers and Puritans. A lot of great stuff to cover here. But anyway, the two quotes. Regarding women in business, Donald Trump said, I hate to tell you, men, generally speaking, women are better than you are. Barack Obama, on the other side of the political divide, said to women in politics, you're better than us. I'm absolutely confident that for 2 years, if every nation on earth was run by women, you'd see a significant improvement across the board on just about everything. And I read those statements because they're indicative of a narrative that has been cast out of ignorance, a narrative that has taken, for example, the Puritans, as you point out, and recast them completely in terms of fact and fiction.
Yes, I have to tell you, even teaching at a Christian university, I have had several students say to me, I never heard anything good about the Puritans until I read your book. So I'm up against a huge barrier as I try to help people understand. No, the Puritans actually had a very high view of marriage. If you read their original literature, their letters to one another, for example, are very affectionate and use affectionate language with one another, very loving. They argued that spiritually women are equal. They actually used language like equality. And they said, oh, sure, in human culture and customs, men and women are treated separately. But in what really matters, which is the spiritual world, men and women are equal before God. And this was a new one for me. Did you know that the first law against wife beating passed anywhere that we know of in the world was the Puritans? The Massachusetts Bay Colony, 1641, passed the first law ever against wife beating. It was soon followed by a law against husband beating, and then a law against beating children and servants. But that gives you some clue to where the Puritans were, that they actually did have a very high view of women and the cultural narrative that we've heard. What was interesting about this is that even my secular historians, as you probably know, if you've looked at the end notes, most of my historians are secular people. And one of them is a very well-known feminist historian. And she was shocked by what she found out about the Puritans. And just to give one example, she said, every treatise on household structure gave wives permission to rebuke the patriarch, you know, to rebuke their husbands if the husbands were sinning. And she was stunned by that, that the Puritans thought, well, certainly women had the spiritual capacity to pass judgment on the husbands when the husbands were sinning. And I give a couple of quotes to show that she was right about that. But even my secular historians were blown away when they actually read the Puritan literature, the affection and love between husbands and wives among the Puritans.
Yeah. And so back to sort of those narrative statements by Trump and by Obama, opposite sides of the political spectrum, but saying essentially the same thing. It is, in essence, a demeaning of true masculinity.
Yes. So that has deep roots, too. We can't really understand a social trend unless we say, where did it start from and how did it develop? And that has very deep roots. You have to go all the way back to the Industrial Revolution. Before that, men worked side by side with their wives and children all day in the family industry, the family farm, the family business. And so the masculine ethos, the cultural expectations for men was very much focused on the caretaking role. You know, they're working with their wives and children all day. So, of course, they need to be gentle and patient, and they have responsibility for the household. In fact, that was the meaning of the term authority. That was a new one for me, by the way. You talk about your aha moments. My aha moments when I was doing the research, they had a very definite definition of authority. It meant the person in charge of the common good. In other words, I look out for what's good for me. You look out for what's good for you. But who looks out for the good of the whole, whether it's the marriage or the family, the church, the school, the society, whatever? That was what authority was for. The person in authority was not supposed to be looking out for his own interest. In fact, their favorite term was disinterested, meaning he was not to look out for his own interest because his job was to look out for the good of the whole. Where did we lose that? The Industrial Revolution was a key turning point because it took work out of the home. Men, of course, had to follow their work out of the home into factories and offices. And that's when you first start to see the literature change. People began to protest that men were losing that caretaking ethos that they had in the colonial era. That, you know, working as an individual, they were becoming individualistic, becoming ambitious, aggressive, self-interested, look out for number one, make it to the top. And the literature of the day began to protest. You know, they didn't like it. They didn't like what they were saying. But it was the first time that you begin to see the male character described in negative terms. And where do they get the quotes that you just had where, you know, women are better? So this was part of the same development. As the public realm developed, it became also more secular. So as factories and industries developed and financial institutions and universities and, of course, the state, they developed this large public sphere. And people began to say that these large public institutions should be run by scientific principles, by which they meant value-free. Just like today, when people say, don't bring your private values into the public arena. So, where in that case, first, two things happened. First, men became more secular, right? They became more secular before women did, right? Because they were getting that secular education, working in that secular sphere. And they tried sometimes to straddle the fence, right? Their sacred secular split. They would operate by secular principles in the workplace and then come home and act as Christian men again. But that, of course, was untenable. But if values are kicked out of the public realm, where will they be cultivated? In the private realm. And who's responsible then? Well, women, because women were then in the private realm. And this is the first time ever in human history that women began to be seen as morally and spiritually superior, which is what you see in those quotes that you mentioned. Up until the 19th century, men were thought to be morally stronger. All the way back to the ancient Greeks and Romans, it was thought that the insight into right and wrong was a rational insight, and men were thought to be more rational. And so men were thought to be more virtuous, stronger virtually. And by the way, even the word virtue comes from the Latin word for man, V-I-R, means man, as in the word virile. So the word virtue had overtones of masculine strength and honor. So up until the 19th century, there was this sudden switch where for the first time, women were seen as morally superior. And men were supposed to come home from that doggy, competitive, rough and tumble world in the public square and come home and be reformed and refined and renewed by their morally superior wives. And women were said to be the moral guardians of society. And I think that double standard is what you see in those quotes that you mentioned at the beginning of this question, you know, that somehow women are morally superior. If women were in charge, they would run things better. There wouldn't be war and conflict. It comes out of the 19th century when virtue was privatized and therefore seen as a more feminine quality for the first time.
You were talking about the Industrial Revolution, and you know that leads me into another aha moment. And as I mentioned before, there were many of them in the book. But this is really interesting to me. You have a piece in the book on why women really did not want to vote. And I think that is so incredibly insightful. Women didn't want to vote, and there were really good reasons for that, because it took the impetus of the man and directed it wrongly.
Yes. So when I mentioned that the book was attacked by Christian egalitarians, this was one section that they hated and that they attacked me for. But I was using the vote as an illustration of a change in political philosophy. You know, I was really using it just as an illustration. So America started out with a dominant political philosophy was something called classical republicanism, which has nothing to do with Democrats and Republicans. It was adopted from the ancient Greeks and Romans. And what it was is an understanding of social institutions like the family or marriage or church as an organic structure with a common good. In other words, it wasn't just individuals coming together with each with their own idea of what was good, but that there was a common good for the marriage, for the family, for the church, for the school, and so on. And the person at authority, back to that, was the one in charge of the common good, responsible for making sure that the interest of the whole were being met, not just the individuals in it. But what about the interest of the whole? And then roughly after the Revolutionary War, about that time, America began to shift to what was called social contract theory. And social contract theory, there is no common good. Social institutions are pictured as so many individuals coming together because they all have the same common interest. We have marriage, for example, since we're talking about men and women in particular, marriage was no longer seen as an organic unity with a common good, but two individuals just coming together because they shared some common interest. Well, social contract theory implied that there is no higher good pulling us together in a marriage or a family, but merely that we share some common interests. And if we no longer share those interests, well, that's okay. We can break up then. And the example I gave was how this affected the debate over the vote. There were a lot of women who were opposed to the vote. In fact, I had so many people skeptical of this that I found quotes from the leading suffragists, the feminists of their day, like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and others, who said the main opposition to female suffrage is women. So they themselves acknowledge that women were the main opponents of female suffrage. And then I have quotes from those women who were against female suffrage. Why? Their answer was that they did not think of it as men's vote versus women's vote. They thought of it as household vote versus individual vote. Hmm. And they wanted to retain that organic view of society where the household had a common good and that the man was responsible for that common good, as opposed to each one of us relates, you know, individually to the state. As you know, there's nobody between me and the state. It's just me, and the individual has no protective barrier between the individual and the state. And the reason that the anti-suffragists were concerned about that was because it reduced the responsibility that society was placing on men. They saw it as a decrease of male responsibility. If men voted as individuals, as opposed to the head of a household, then he was no longer being held responsible for the common good of the household. So it was letting men off the hook. It was reducing their responsibility. That's how they saw it. Now, of course, eventually women came to support female suffrage, and there were two reasons for that. One was, as soon as there was universal male suffrage, well, then the meaning of the vote had changed. If men who were not head of a household could vote, then obviously the vote no longer meant the good of the household. You know, I represent the good of the household. Now the vote meant an individual man. And if the vote meant an individual, then women quite logically concluded that they'd better represent themselves too as individuals. And the second reason was that women began to portray the vote as a way to protect the family. The Women's Christian Temperance Movement, which was the largest women's movement ever in American history, so we're not talking about something small, began to portray the vote as a way to get women's voice into the public realm. And of course, they thought women were more loving and kind and compassionate and considerate, and it would bring a kinder voice, a kinder, gentler voice into the public arena. And she argued especially that women who had drunken husbands who were spending their money at bars on alcohol instead of bringing money home to support their wives and children, and then because they were drunk, they were coming home and beating their wives. They said, how do these women have any voice? How do they have any way to protect themselves? And so the Women's Christian Temperance Movement started to portray the vote as an opportunity for women to fight alcoholism. And so it took on overtones of protecting the home. In fact, she called it the head of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, Frances Willard. She called the vote the home protection ballot. And so that got a lot of women finally in favor of the vote. But I thought it was an interesting debate just because it showed how America shifted from an organic view of society that held men responsible for the common good to an individualistic view of society, which pretty much let men off the hook. It said, no, society is not going to hold you responsible for the common good of your marriage, your family, the church, you know, wherever you hold authority.
You do the most delicious job of turning the tables so often in this debate. I just love it. In terms of letting men off the hook, so you're sort of taming men, you're elevating women, but the turning of the tables is this lets men off the hook. And this became part of the reform movements in general. The novels themselves let men off the hook because it was demonizing men, and therefore men were, well, they were simply let off the hook in terms of their responsibility. This is just part of your personality. This is part of your nature. Therefore, you can't be held responsible for it.
Right. So there was a huge mushrooming of reform movements in the 19th century. You know, we talked about the Industrial Revolution. Men's behavior was growing worse. As I said, society was secularizing. Men were not attending church as often. They were not feeling as bound by Christian moral ethic. And so there was a great increase in drinking, gambling, fighting, crime, prostitution. Sometimes a single fact can kind of crystallize it for you. In 1830, Americans drank more, three times as much as Americans drink today. So there was a reason there was a temperance movement. There were movements, well, there was the abolition movement against slavery, of course. There were movements against prostitution and sex trafficking. There were movements to help orphans. There were a host of movements. In fact, historians refer to this network of movements collectively as the Benevolent Empire. And most of them were won by women, because now that women, as I said earlier, had been made the moral guardians of society, they said, well, we've got to go out in public and solve these moral issues. Well, the trouble, of course, is that most of these movements, reform movements, were aimed at what were traditionally male vices, like drinking. Well, let me give a quote. So this is one of my favorite feminist quotes. A feminist historian says, there was little doubt as to the sex of the tavern keepers, the slaveholders, the drunkards, and the seducers. And so there was a tone, there was a sexual antagonism happening with these moral reforms as well. And unfortunately, what it meant is, more and more society was just accepting that men were naturally lewd, rude, and crude, and that it was up to women to tame them. And so this double standard, you know, I think it's still happening today. I was interviewed not long ago on a podcast with a young couple. And so this is my chance to find out how they thought, was the double standard still evident in the Christian church? And they said, oh, absolutely. In the dating scene, for example, they said, it is just expected that boys are always going to push the envelope sexually, that boys are going to be more prone to porn and other, you know, sin and vice, and that it's up to women to be the gatekeepers, to hold the line, you know, to make sure that they don't violate the moral standards. They said very much that same double standard they think is still in the church today. But it's good to know where it came from. It starts back with the Industrial Revolution, when men were no longer held responsible for their families in the same way.
And we're let off the hook. You know, one of the points you make in this book as well that, you know, I'm just calling these aha moments because there's so many of them, and I'm thinking about them as we're going through this podcast. But in the ancient world, people recognized that the rejection of abortion was to be pro-woman. In the contemporary world, to oppose abortion is seen as being anti-woman. That is a disjuncture that many people do not know about.
Yes, today we don't realize that abortion is essentially saying that a woman should be more like a man. You know, that in order to make it in society today, women have to deny that which characterizes them most as women. Of course, as human, we share a lot of things in common with men. But as women, you know, what's distinctive about women is, of course, that we are the ones who bear children. And unfortunately, I think the message for a long time has been, if women want to make it, if they want to have that interesting professional life, if they want to develop their skills, they have to be more like men. And what does that mean? That means they have to control their fertility. They have to be able to determine when they're going to have children. And, you know, if the child comes at the wrong time, they have to have the right to abortion. And after their children are born, they have to have the right to daycare, preferably state-funded daycare, so that they could be just as available to the workplace as men are. And so to me, that sounds like an obvious denigration of women, because it's saying you don't have value unless you can function essentially as a man. And abortion is one of the key tools for that. So, and it's true. I mean, let's face it, pregnancy coming at an awkward time can be very difficult. I was in seminary when I became pregnant with my first child. And I was in crisis about it, to tell you the truth, because I didn't know how to pursue my deepest interest except through the academic world. You know, those are my interests. And I thought, like, having to drop out of seminary felt like falling into a black hole. No, it turned out I loved being a mother. I homeschooled my kids. I wanted more time with my kids. And I've worked part-time from home most of my career. But I can understand why women sometimes do find it difficult to have to drop out of a job or drop out of work or fall into poverty because they had a child. So, you know, we want to be understanding about this. But ultimately, the message that you must be like a man, who should adapt? I say the workplace should adapt, not the woman. I say the education system should adapt. You know, if women are the ones who have babies, we should adapt to that and not force them to feel like, well, you know, the only way you can accommodate is to drop out or have an abortion. I mean, so many women feel that way. So all that to say, we should change our society to be welcoming to children instead of changing women's biological functions so that they fit better into a male world.
You know, this is another, I didn't mean to get to this early, but that's another aha moment. You talk about the Industrial Revolution. It brought in the reform movements in general, brought so many problems to the table. And you say you can't really go back to the agrarian culture, but you can, because of technology, do things today that we weren't able to do, even in the agrarian culture. So you can bring men and women back into the home with equal responsibility in terms of rearing their children. So you can have a healthy family nucleus once again.
Yeah, I do think that the ideal is for both men and women to be able to do economically productive work while raising their children, which is what they did have prior to the Industrial Revolution. You know, since we've talked about feminism a bit, I mean, obviously, one reason for the feminist movement is that when men left, you know, when the Industrial Revolution took men's work out of the home, of course, it took women's work out of the home as well. You cannot be a Proverbs 31 woman in the same way, running all these businesses from home, or rather, that's been our assumption. I would like us to go back to saying, yes, you can. But I'll have a whole chapter on practical ways that we can maybe flex the workplace. People don't realize this, but surveys show that men report just as much work-family tension as women do. That many men do report feeling that constant grief that they're not as involved with their children as they would like to be. And so the pandemic had a very slight silver lining, which is that a lot of fathers discovered they did like being home more and being closer to their children. 65% of American fathers in one survey said they did not want to go back to the office full time when the pandemic ends. And the New York Times had an article titled something like, "During the pandemic, fathers got closer to their children and they don't want to lose that." I love that. So in the book, I give a lot of anecdotes. You know, that's about all you can do right now is just here's anecdotes. Here's how various people have succeeded in creating a flexible workplace. One of my graduate students is married to an IT professional, and he came home during the pandemic. And because he was working from home, he was able to be more involved in their family's homeschooling. He decided he would be the one to make lunch every day. He was able to take his kids to soccer practice and choir practice. And he picked up so many of the family responsibilities that his wife was able to start a part-time business. She's an opera singer. I have a student who was an opera singer. And so she started a voice studio, and the whole family benefited from the additional income. So I interviewed her husband, and he said to me, "Our family is so much more balanced now. I am never going back to a cubicle." And the final kicker is he said, The time I used to spend commuting to work, I now spend praying with my wife. And I thought, okay, this is a great example that you can help people. I have several more examples, mostly my students who found ways. But I also had to quote CEOs, right? Because we have to convince the workplace that this is good as well. And it was interesting. I quote found CEOs who said, you know, we did not want to experiment with home-based work because we were afraid people were going to slough off and productivity would go down. And they said the pandemic has completely exploded that fear. We did not see a reduction in productivity. In fact, if anything, people work more when they work from home because they're not losing time commuting to work. They're not wasting as much time in unnecessary meetings and so on. People who work from home, you almost have to tell them to stop, right? So we have to help people to understand that this is a win-win for both sides. It's a win-win for businesses as well as a win-win for families.
Whenever I think of you, Nancy, I think of you sort of in harmony with Jay Richards because both of you are masters at exploding mythology. So you take these myths and you explode them and you expose the utter bankruptcy of the mythology. I want you to take a moment to debunk the romantic movement and the myth of the noble savage.
Yeah, so the reason this is relevant is again, the Industrial Revolution was such a turning point. As men were no longer growing up in the farms and living outdoors and being, you know, hardy, strong farm boys, they were coming into the city and working in bureaucracies and working at desk jobs. People began to worry that men were becoming emasculated. They were becoming soft and effeminate. And there was actually a new word that entered the English vocabulary. The new word was over-civilized. Men were becoming over-civilized and they needed to find a way to recover their manhood. Unfortunately, the answer that many of them gave was that they needed to get away from civilization, away from their wives and children, out into nature, go out and be a cowboy, you know, roping cattle with the cowboys and sleeping under the stars, or frontier man, or a hunter, trapper, backwoodsman, and so on. And this was inspired partly by the romantic idea of the noble savage. The savage didn't have a negative connotation back then, by the way. But the noble savage who, you know, is because he's closer to nature, he's somehow more noble and more courageous than the poor civilized man in our Western society. And it was also driven, though, by Darwinism. You may have that question coming up, so I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but it was also influenced by the rise of Darwinian thought because Darwinian thinkers said your true nature is, you know, you're an animal, right? You're basically a beast. The Darwinian thinkers began to argue that the men who came out on top in the struggle for survival would by necessity be ruthless, rugged, savage, barbarian, and even predatory. And so the way to recover your true manhood was by leaving civilization behind again and by discovering the beast within. This is when the Tarzan stories became popular, for example. And the son of the author says they were explicitly written to give fictional form to the idea that men are just part of the animal world. That's all we are. And so Tarzan, of course, he retains that inner wildness, that inner courage, because he's been raised by the apes. And even after he learns European customs and languages, he turns to Jane and he says, I'm still a wild beast at heart. And of course, there was a more serious literature too. There was a whole genre called literary naturalism, which also was giving fictional form to a Darwinian worldview. The best known is Jack London. And as a young man, he read Darwinian literature. He read Darwin's writings so thoroughly that he could quote passages by heart. And one historian said he experienced a conversion experience, what she called it, to radical materialism by reading Darwin. You know, his books are mostly about dogs, but they're intended as metaphors, of course, for human beings. And his message is human beings are products of natural selection, genes and environment. They have no real free will. And so between the noble savage and Darwinism, the idea grew that to find your true manhood, you need to get away from civilization, away from the influence of marriage and family. And I think this is a highly destructive message because it's essentially telling men your true nature is not in marriage and family. You know, it's getting away from that. That marriage, well, it's the Playboy message, right? Playboy specifically says your true self is not in marriage, But, you know, in your wild, free, adventuresome self, then that marriage ties you down and it's against your true nature. And so the way I counter that is with the cultural mandate. You know, about half my class doesn't know what cultural mandate is, but in Genesis, when God creates the universe, he creates the earth, he creates the trees and plants, he creates the animals, and then he finally creates the humans as the apex of his creation. And what's the first thing he says to them? First thing he does is tell them why he created them. You know, what's your purpose? Be fruitful and multiply and subdue the earth. And in the streamlined language of Genesis, we can sort of unpack what that means. Be fruitful and multiply is not just your immediate family. It historically, all the social institutions grow out of the family. You know, it becomes a clan, becomes a village, becomes a nation. And of course, social institutions are formed for certain functions like the marketplace, the school, the state. And then the treaties and constitutions that govern these groups. So the entire social world is what we're called to develop in Genesis. Subdue the earth means harness the natural resources. So, of course, historically, it usually starts with farming, but also mining, technology, inventing computers, composing music. One of my students said, "Oh, come on, composing music." So I play the violin and I said, "What's the violin made out of? Wood. And what's the bow made out of? Horsehair." So all the transcendent beauty that you associate with music starts with harnessing the natural resources, you know, in nature. So this is often called the cultural mandate because what it means is that humans were originally created to create cultures, to create civilizations, to make history. And this is before the fall. So after the fall, you know, God has put us on a track. In sin, we fall off the track. In salvation, God puts us back on the track. But what was the track? You go back to the before the fall, it's the cultural mandate. So men do not find their ultimate sense of masculinity by getting away from women and children and civilization. They find their ultimate fulfillment by rolling up their sleeves and digging deeply into their social responsibilities, starting with their family, and digging deeply into creative and productive work that serves other people.
I want to stay on the subject of Darwinism, but I want to ask you one sort of tangential question, and that is the Victorian Jesus, meek and mild. What does this have to do with the whole idea of toxic masculinity?
Yeah, so during the 19th century, a lot of Christians were becoming theologically liberal, meaning that they were starting to deny this supernatural element. The essence of liberalism is just to deny the supernatural. You know, Jesus wasn't really divine, son of God. He was a moral exemplar, right? Or they denied the Trinity, for example, and they denied the miracles that Jesus did. They denied anything that was supernatural. They denied that the Bible was divine revelation. No, the Bible was just the best religious insights over the generations. You know, the people who wrote it, that was their insights. And so liberalism was getting rid of the content of Christianity, but they wanted to retain the feelings of religion because religion gave them nice emotional feelings, emotional experiences. The first liberal theologian was Schleiermacher in Germany, and he redefined religion as the feeling of dependence. There you go. So, as a result, liberalism became very emotional and focused primarily on emotional engagement. Correct doctrine didn't really matter, but good feelings mattered. And so you can see why liberalism then led to a very pale and sentimental, a sentimental vision of Jesus. Jesus becomes this pale, sweet, like you said, meek and mild. In fact, that was a song that was common at the Victorian age. Gentle Jesus, meek and mild, look on me, a little child. That was a prayer taught to children. And so as a result, people began to feel that Christianity was emasculating. You know, that Jesus himself was this almost effeminate character. And so there was a reaction against that. And I think a good reaction. I think it was an important course correction. Fundamentalism in the early 20th century stood against that, said, okay, we need to recover some sense of masculinity here. Christianity, you know, in opposition to liberalism, Christianity does care about correct doctrine, it does care about truth. And we need to be strong and bold in fighting for truth. And so the fundamentalists, in some ways, almost overcompensated because they began to say Christianity is a manly religion. The manliest man is the man in the pulpit because he has to be able to fight against, you know, heresy and liberalism. So there was, like I said, in many ways, it was a good course correction because the fundamentalists said we want to have an alternative to that highly sentimental, almost effeminate style of liberalism. So I'm starting to wonder if I'm answering your question.
No, you are. You are. I mean, basically what I was driving at is here you have Jesus is meek and mild. But as you point out, meekness is not about being soft. Meekness is power under control. So you have this kind of whipsaw because people didn't understand the biblical language. And so you get a completely different impression of Christianity and certainly the Christ of Christianity.
That's good. Yeah, that's a good point. In my book, I do go to the word meek in the Greek. What did it mean in the first century? And it certainly didn't mean wimpy, you know, or soft. Meek was used by Greek writers at the time, Xenophon, I think it was, who used it of a war horse that was well-trained. That was what meek was. I mean, this is strength under control. Plato used it. Plato and Aristotle both used it as a general who is kind to a conquered people. You know, if he's conquered the people, he has a right to just wipe them out. But no, he's kind to them. So that was the meaning. I pulled together some of those meanings that were from the first century to give us a notion of what the word meant back then. And you're right. Sort of the general meaning is not that you're weak. You're strong, but you know how to control it. You know how to channel it to do good.
You know, I want to get back to what you're talking about with respect to Darwinism, because that section in the book is worth the price of admission. You talk about the role that Darwinian evolution played in the denigration of women, but also in the degradation of masculinity. And I think it's so powerful. In terms of the degradation of women, Darwin's view was that women were inferior to men, that a man can attain to a higher eminence in whatever he takes up than can a woman. There are all kinds of Darwinian quotes over the years that I've memorized in this regard, and some of them are encapsulated in your book as well. But this leads to a false view, not only of masculinity, but it is an absolute slam against women.
Exactly, which is why I wonder why feminists are not up in arms against Darwin more than they are. You know, they should be protesting Darwin. Yes, Darwin's explicitly, as you say, explicitly argued that women were intellectually inferior to men. By the way, he acknowledged that women had greater sensitivity and intuitiveness. But then he said, those are traits of the lower species. And so even women's strengths were seen as signs of her inferiority. And Thomas Huxley, who was nicknamed Darwin's bulldog, argued that because women's inferiority was the product of natural selection, it could not even be fixed by a program of educational selection. In other words, you couldn't educate them out of their inferiority. You know, there was no hope for them. But let me give you another quote, because this is even more colorful. The main popularizer of Darwinism here in America was a sociologist named Herbert Spencer. And he argued explicitly that the men who won out in the struggle for survival would be, you know, these brutal barbarian savages. And so you ask him, how do women put up with such brutal men then? And his answer was, well, they had to learn the ability to please. And it would also help if they learned how to hide their resentment at such poor treatment. So the message of evolution apparently was that men are brutal beasts, and women need to learn how to please and placate and hide their true feelings. So I'm with you. Like, why aren't the feminists up in arms here? But it also, of course, denigrated men. And this is what I can't understand, is why some people haven't seen this part of it. Because Darwinian thought has come back in our own day. You know, it was called social Darwinism for a while, right? The application of Darwinism to social issues. And it was discredited in some ways. And so it's come back under the label of evolutionary psychology. And evolutionary psychologists are just as demeaning to men as they are to women. There was a best-selling book, called The Moral Animal. And the author says that the human male is a possessive, oppressive, flesh-obsessed pig. And then he says, trying to teach men how to have a good marriage is like offering Vikings a free book on how not to pillage. In other words, it's, you know, they're not going to take your advice. And I thought, this is a best-selling book. Don't people see how disparaging this is of men? And then there's a book by George Gilder. And George Gilder, also was an evolutionary psychologist, wrote a book. It was originally called Sexual Suicide. It was reissued under the name Men and Marriage. But his description is even more colorful. He says the single man, you know, who's not being tamed by a woman, is prone to crime, irresponsible, drug addicted. I'll have to memorize the list of adjectives sometime. But he portrays men as completely unfulfilled and irresponsible and having no direction or purpose in life until a woman gets a hold of him. But this is the part that I find most offensive. He says, it's women who tame men, and it's the woman's morality that a man has to accept. And I'm like, wait a minute. What man is going to accept a morality that's defined as a woman's morality? I mean, isn't it God's morality that we want men to adopt? I'm surprised that many Christians like this book because they are not quite seeing what he's saying, I guess. He is saying that men become productive members of society if they submit, that's his word, if they submit to a woman's sense of morality, because here's how he justifies it. Men's sexual activity is done in a moment. Women's sexuality is over a very long time horizon because they get pregnant and nursing and raising children. And so men need to submit to a woman's sexual rhythms. You know, they need to submit to women and to a woman's form of sexuality. And if a woman doesn't succeed in doing that, it's her fault, by the way. So it denigrates men, but then it also lets them off the hook again. Because if the woman doesn't succeed in taming him, then it's her fault. And history is full of abandoned women and children, as we know. If a man really is the barbarian that George Gilder paints him as, first of all, what woman would be strong enough to tame him? And number two, what woman would want to? I have two chapters at the end on domestic violence. And let's face it, men are bigger, stronger, and faster. Women are not going to ever be in a position to civilize men or tame men. Men have to be responsible before God for God's moral demands on them and not slough it off and say, well, it's women's job to tame or civilize men. I think it's a very harmful message.
Yeah, and the cover story in Time magazine, and you actually quote this in your books, was subtitled, Infidelity, It May Be in Our Genes, Another Way of Letting Men Off the Hook. Because you're saying this is just part of our evolutionary biology.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, so one theme that's common among evolutionary biologists is, well, we judge human behavior by how well it gets your genes into the next generation, right? For evolution, that's all that counts. And so there are people, Steven Pinker was the one who was quoted there. He's at Harvard, psychologist, best-selling author. And he's one of the people who makes this argument that a man is more successful in evolutionary terms if he can spread his seed far and wide. And so that lots of women are raising his children. His children get into the next generation. To which I say, actually, that's not even true scientifically. Infants are extremely fragile. They need extensive care by both parents for years and years. If a man impregnates one woman and then runs off to his next sexual conquest, that child is not likely to survive. And so evolution, if evolution were true, evolution should select for devoted fathers and faithful husbands if they really want to have their genes successfully survive into the next generation.
I want you to comment on a particular quote that I got from your book. Again, all this information, The Toxic War and Masculinity. It's a book, again, that is worth reading and rereading because there are so many aha moments. But I love this quote. As Christian psychologist Mary Stuart Van Leeuwen explains, Once you have reduced all behavioral tendencies to inexorable genetic mechanisms, then humans are no more responsible for their behavior than my local ATM machine is when it fails to give me the money. I'm trying to withdraw from my account. You cannot get ethics from mechanics. So the obvious evolutionary default setting is simply that might makes right. I think that is such a powerful quote. It is so graphic, and it shows the utter bankruptcy of materialism.
It does, because if we're just material, complex biochemical machines, we have no free will. And by the way, she was responding in particular there to evolutionary psychologists who put out a book, it was several years ago now, on rape. It was called A Natural History of Rape. It was by a biologist and an anthropologist. And their argument was, rape is, well, let me back up. Any trait that exists today must have some evolutionary advantage. Otherwise, it would have been weeded out by natural selection. So they took the topic of rape and they said, well, it must have some evolutionary advantage. And so they spent the whole book trying to find ways in which rape could have some evolutionary advantage. Basically, they argue that if a man can't woo a woman, you know, flowers and candy don't do the trick, then he may resort to coercion to fulfill the reproductive imperative, because, you know, that's all he is a reproductive machine, right? And I actually heard them, one of the authors was on NPR back when the book first came out, and I heard him. I listened to the debate, and he said several times he used the phrase, that's not a debatable matter. What he meant was, it's pure logic. You know, if a trait survives today, it must have some survival value. And we need to find some survival value, even in the crime of rape. And he said, it's not a debatable matter. And so Mary Stu Van Leeuwen there was responding to that example and saying, well, actually, if we are just machines, biochemical machines, these guys have a point. In other words, they're being ultimately logical when they say, let's find some benefit even in rape, because there's no free will. We're just machines. We're like the ATM machine, like she says. You can't get ethics from mechanics, I think is how she said it, right? If we're just machines, mechanics, there you can't get an ethical principle. And might makes right. So if the man is stronger, I mean, we're back to Marquis de Sade. Remember, sadism, the word sadism comes from Marquis de Sade, who argued men are stronger. Hey, if nature is all that exists, men are stronger. Therefore, men have a right to take whatever they can take, whatever they can get. And so that's where that quote is applying even to something like rape. It suggests that, well, it lets men off the hook again, doesn't it? It says you're just driven by an evolutionary reproductive imperative. So there's little we can do about it. Just as just the male nature.
And I think one of the things we need to get back to, I mean, we've talked about the counterfeit, but the real is the biblical perspective on manhood or masculinity. And the biblical view of manhood offers men a far greater dignity than the secular view, a point that you make so eloquently in the book.
Yeah, well, you almost kind of covered already when you talked about Jesus. But there is a secular historian who makes this point very well. Whenever I can, I like to quote secular people and say, see, even they recognize it. So there was a secular historian who said, your view of God is what determines your view of masculinity. And so he starts with polytheism, the Norse gods, the Greek gods. And he says, here's how he puts it. In these religions, the gods drank, they wenched, they fought, they trumpeted their power. So polytheism tends to hold up the heroic virtues. The real man is the warrior. And there's some truth to that, of course, but it's incomplete. So then he goes on to monotheism. And one form of monotheism proposes that God is so transcendent that he has no relationship to humans. This would be Islam, for example. I found a quote from an Islamic writer who said, the idea that Allah would condescend to have a personal relationship with mere mortals, you know, is demeaning to him. So in that form of monotheism, the concept of masculinity focuses on power and authority. Then this secular historian says, well, there's a monotheism of Judaism, though, which is different because God does have a covenant relationship with his people. And so in Judaism, the real man is the loving father. Then he says Christianity arises from within Judaism. And he says it complexifies everything because Jesus does introduce the notion of servant leadership, which he says no other religion has. No other religion has a God who serves his people. Jesus says, you know, the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. And so this historian says Christianity introduced the idea that you could have power and authority also with gentleness, love, and compassion. He says, in fact, he sounds kind of puzzled because he said, you know, Christianity actually calls certain virtues masculine virtues that most cultures have stereotypically thought were feminine virtues. But in Christianity, they become masculine virtues, gentleness, love, compassion. And so in Christianity, men are called to be both courageous and caring, right? Both tough and tender. So they are called to be whole persons. We don't want to give in to any limited stereotype of masculinity. Men are made in God's image to be whole persons.
You write about this so wonderfully in the book. What makes men really happy? I mean, what's the determining factor for true joy and happiness? And again, it gets into the biblical perspective for manhood.
Yes, you know, it made me really think about the first and second greatest commandments, to love God and to love your neighbor. Wait a minute, love? That's for men too, not just women, right? The very notion that men's greatest fulfillment is in relationship, both to God and to people, is revolutionary. We just rattle this off and don't think about it, that men's greatest fulfillment comes from love. And of course, I also go back again to the cultural mandate because, well, especially I think in America, we have kind of an individualistic philosophy where men are not encouraged to develop their relational skills. They're not encouraged to find their fulfillment in marriage, family, and even friendship, you know, male friendships. And so I go back to the cultural mandate. About four times in the book, I go back to the cultural mandate because it's so important for countering all of these stereotypes that, you know, men are just naturally loners, the kind of lone rangers. They find their fulfillment getting out, you know, being the noble savage, to use that term again. No, the cultural mandate says, no, you find your greatest fulfillment, first of all, building up the social world, starting with your wife and children, your church. And you find your greatest fulfillment doing creative, productive work that serves others. I just keep calling men back to that cultural mandate over and over again. I think it's incredibly important today when even Christian books are out there saying, to some degree, there are some Christian books saying, you know, you find your greatest fulfillment going out into the climbing mountains and hunting elk. You've seen some of those books. And I think, no, we need to really teach the cultural mandate again, that the Bible isn't only about what to do about your sin. It goes back to before the fall to tell us what our inherent purpose is as human beings.
Yeah, I think this is one of the reasons this book is so transcendently important, because if you have an improper view of masculinity, if you have an improper worldview, even within the Christian church, you can go off on all kinds of tangents, tangents that you write about in the book, like the tangent of muscular Christianity. And then you have all of these permutations of that. So you're looking for the solution in all the wrong places. And that secular narrative then is even being bought into by pastors and the culture and the church.
Yes, I get a lot of questions about that because I think the muscular Christianity is coming back. Maybe not that exact phrase, but certainly, well, we have the manosphere, right? I do talk a little bit about the manosphere, these online men's groups that are promoting, you know, hyper masculinity. We don't need women and use women just for sex, but don't have relationships with them. And there is a Christian version of the manosphere too that's developing. And I just got an email from a former graduate student who now is teaching at a Christian school. And she said, your book is so important because many of our boys, high school boys, are following Andrew Tate. And they're even in the yearbook, they wanted quotes from Andrew Tate under their photo. And she said, we have a huge hunger among Christian young men to have a biblical, healthy, strong, respected view of masculinity. So I think you're right. If we don't get a biblical view out there, even Christian men are kind of drifting towards the manosphere. And some, I mean, Jordan Peterson, I think, is obviously has a lot of influence even on Christian young people. And I don't think his is harmful. But when they go off, have you followed Andrew Tate? I mean, with the lawsuit now against him, the evidence is coming out pretty clearly that he is trafficking women and he is abusing them. And we have to be very careful that our Christian young men are not going off into a dangerous form of masculinity. So we need to make sure that we're giving them a positive alternative. And, you know, back to what we were talking about earlier with fatherhood, the most important long-term solution to toxic behavior in men is the father-son relationship. I quote a psychiatrist who says, we're not going to have a better class of men until we have a better class of fathers, because that father-son relationship is what trains boys and what it means to be a man. What is true masculinity? And another, a science writer, wrote an article in which he said, it turns out it's not even the father's masculinity that matters. It's the warm relationship with his children. There was a 35-year-long study done on whether children adopt the religion of their parents, you know, whether they stay Christian, in other words. This was the longest study ever done, won all kinds of awards. And what the researcher found was that, first of all, they found that fathers had more influence than mothers. If the father was a Christian, the children were more likely to follow him than if the mother was a Christian. So that tells you something right there. Men have influence whether they want to or not. The second thing he found, though, was the influence the father has is primarily due to the warm personal relationship with the children. If the father is a paragon of virtue and has correct doctrine and is a pillar of the church, but doesn't love his kids, the kids won't follow him. They will not stay Christian. It depends on fathers actually having a loving, warm relationship with their kids. So this is where the challenge to the church is, teaching fathers to be deeply involved with their children. And I would say also reaching out to fatherless kids. You realize that 40% of children in America are growing up apart from their natural fathers. It's the highest percentage of single parenthood in the world. So we have a huge ministry opportunity to minister to these fatherless boys. I think churches should make this number one ministry. Ministry to fatherless boys, because research has found that father substitutes can have a great impact. Church youth group leaders, coaches, teachers, and so on can have a great impact on young men. So if we're concerned about toxic behavior in men, we need to look to the next generation.
You keep using the word father, and what's interesting in the book is you make the dichotomy between father and dad. And I think that's an important issue as well, that kids have the necessity to see a father figure as opposed to just a friend.
Yeah, and that has a historical basis as well. You know, I love to show where these things come from. At the Industrial Revolution, men are taken out of the home, and for the first time, they're not intimately involved with their sons. They're not teaching them day by day. They're not teaching them adult skills. And fathers begin to be seen as irrelevant. People begin to say, well, what do fathers do anyway in the family? I quote one fictional book at the time where a child says, I can't figure out why God invented fathers. For the first time, fathers were seen as irrelevant, insignificant, and even incompetent. In other words, if they're not closely involved with their kids, they don't know what their kids need. They don't know how their kids are feeling. They don't know their kids' experiences. And so they become out of touch. And they've already in the 19th century, you begin to get these images of fathers as incompetent doofuses, you know, the doofus dad, the dimwit dad, which now, of course, is all over our media, advertisements, movies, etc. And that the switch from father to dad is, I think it was 1930. There was an illustration of that was a 1930 Boy Scout pamphlet that said, you know, the father is no longer seen as this bewhiskered, austere authority. Today, it's dad. That was actually the way that it was expressed by this Boy Scout pamphlet. He's no longer an austere authority. He's dad. He's fun. He's the pal. He's your friend. And so as men no longer taught their kids serious things, you know, they were no longer teaching them intellectual skills or, you know, work skills. Their role was reduced to being a pal, being a friend, you know, being a playmate. And I have to tell you, when I had reading groups on the book, on the manuscript, there were people who pushed back on that and said, well, it's good for men to play with their children. Yes, it's good for fathers to play with their children. But you realize this was a huge reduction in their traditional role from being teacher and authority and, you know, the person who introduces you to the skills you need for the adult world to being a playmate. It was a huge reduction in their role. And I agree with you. I give several more examples, but why would men want to become fathers if fathers are mocked and ridiculed in the media? I think it's one of the reasons that men are dropping out of family life, not even becoming married, not having children, because the role of father has been so denigrated. So I think it's very harmful. In the church, that's another thing we should be working on, is reviving the respect for the father's role in the family.
Nancy, is there such a thing as toxic femininity?
Well, you know, it's a book on men, so I didn't address that. Because I do get...
You actually allude to it in the book.
Yeah, I do get questions about that. I do a little bit on femininity, because obviously you can't talk about men without the relationship to women. But to keep the book manageable in length, I don't deal a lot with feminism, femininity. Toxic femininity, I'm not sure which part you're alluding to, but I would think maybe it's where I quote Playboy, and then I show that many of the early feminists in the 1960s had the same language as Playboy. When Betty Friedan writes The Feminine Mystique, what does she do? She actually sympathizes with men who disrespect their wives. She says, well, yeah, wives are just parasites. They're idle. They're childlike. Women who want to just be homemakers and not develop their intellect, not develop their minds, are these childish parasites. And of course, men don't like, here's the language she uses. She says, these wives become millstones around their necks. And all of the feminist leaders at that time, I give other quotes as well, all refer to the married woman as a parasite, as a leech. I would call that toxic femininity myself, because it definitely denigrates women in their uniquely feminine role of being mothers and raising children. No wonder so many women say, I'm just a housewife, you know, that language, because they sense the scorn and the disdain that came a lot from the feminist movement. So I think that's pretty toxic.
I want to end the podcast with sort of a personal note. I would only bring it up because you bring it up in the book. You talk about the significance of having an authentic father, a father that's not a Jekyll and a Hyde, a father that's not one way in private and another way in public, and the enormous impact it has on children when fathers are not authentic. You experienced that, and that was one of the reasons you walked away from the Christian faith.
Absolutely. Yeah, I had a very abusive childhood. My father was very physically abusive. Books on abuse will sometimes say, was it open hand or closed fist? It was closed fist. And he would say, you know, if you don't do this, I'll beat you. So he's very open about it. And a Christian psychologist read my book and said, well, we know you're not writing from an ivory tower. You're writing from the trenches. You really did have to work through yourself to a healthy, biblical, positive view of masculinity. And it is also the reason we said earlier that nominal Christian men have the highest rate of domestic violence. And so I did have to deal with that in the book. I have two chapters at the end on domestic violence, on how churches can respond more effectively. And so, you know, my experience taught me a lot about how to write those two chapters. But the way I put it in the introduction is, in a sense, I've been writing this book my whole life. Because when trauma is that severe, it does take your whole life to recover from it. And the interesting part of it, which I had not ever told anyone, well, I haven't talked about my father ever in any of my previous books, but also I haven't talked about the healing I got. It was at LaBrie. At LaBrie, we talked about that at the beginning of the podcast. At LaBrie, not only did I discover apologetics, which was hugely influential, but on staff at LaBrie was a psychiatric social worker. And she was there because she understood that for many people, the barriers to becoming a Christian are not only intellectual, but also emotional and psychological, especially in Christian families where maybe it's bound up with, you know, reacting against your parents. And of course, as my intellectual questions were answered, then I was free to start thinking about, well, wait a minute, I think I do have some emotional barriers too, because whatever my father was, I did not want to be. If he was a Christian, I didn't want to be a Christian. Whatever he was, I wanted the opposite. So it was a big part of both becoming a Christian, having to work through the trauma of my childhood, but also a lot of my growth as a Christian has been in very deep emotional and psychological healing. But what I think is what I'm very grateful for is I got both of those at LaBrie, right? At LaBrie, I got both the intellectual input and the beginning of spiritual healing. The psychiatric social worker was named Sheila Bird and called her Birdie. And I had just never experienced the quality of love that I experienced with Birdie. When I left LaBrie, when I prayed, I kind of thought of Birdie in the sky. You know, I thought of, okay, God's love is going to be like Birdie's. You know, if you have a human example of that kind of love, it really helps you to experience God's love the same way. And love is what heals. It's hard to explain, but love heals. You know, if you can work yourself to a profound, deep, transformative experience of God's love, that is what ultimately heals that kind of trauma, that kind of emotional wounding that you may carry from your childhood.
Yeah, this is such an incredible book. It underscores the importance of a healthy biblical view, as you said, of masculinity. You are a brilliant writer, a great communicator. You have used your life to make a difference in the lives of so many people. I've certainly been impacted by your life and ministry, and I truly love this book. I think, as you said somewhere in the podcast, nothing is more important in terms of pillars to civilization than family. And so when you have a toxic war on masculinity, that affects the entirety of the human race. And so I think this is a book that needs to be read, not only read, but studied. And one of the things I appreciate that you did in this book is you put a very comprehensive study guide in the back of the book so that people can take this and not just read it, put it away on the shelf, but actually make a difference. This is part and parcel of rescuing a declining Western civilization. And I am deeply grateful that you wrote this book.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate that. And I totally agree with you. I do think the family is the center of civilization. And by the way, as long as we're on that point, the reason Christian men test out as the most loving husbands and fathers is because when the researchers said, well, why is that? What is it that makes the difference? Their gender theory doesn't make the difference. What is it? It turns out it's their commitment to the family. It's their family-centered view. If they believe the family is the center of society, the pillar of civilization, and that my family should be my top priority, that's why evangelical men test out as the most loving fathers and husbands.
Well, I think it's a great privilege to have had an hour or so to talk to you about the toxic war on masculinity, and a privilege for all of our podcast listeners to be able to listen in on the conversation, to get the book, to read the book. I hope many churches will use this book as well. We're talking about a major pillar of Western civilization. You think on the foundation of life, what's more important than family? You know, certainly government is important. The church is the epicenter of the universe, but family is the epicenter of the church itself. It's the epicenter of human civilization. So an incredibly important book. It's not just another book. It's a seminal book, and I hope that people listening to me right now will take the opportunity to get a copy of the book. It is available for standing shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. You can get the book on the web at equip.org or simply write me at P.O. Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. And by the way, if you enjoy the podcast, please subscribe, rate, and review. It helps a lot. Nancy, once again, thank you so much. You have blessed our audience.
Thanks for having me. And I have to tell you, you asked the most probing and interesting questions. So this has been wonderful.
Bless you, Nancy. I appreciate you. I follow your ministry, and I'm deeply appreciative of the difference you're making while there's yet time.